Welcome back to day 6 of Rohatsu Sesshin. We may be more used to 5-day or 3-day Sesshin, so for those of us in it for the long haul, these are like bonus days. Since we're celebrating the Buddha's awakening, the Buddha's ceremony of enlightenment this week. The Buddha Shakyamuni talked about before his awakening. Some of his thoughts, some of his reflections before his awakening. He said, "Monks, there are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. What's the ignoble search? Here, someone being subject to birth seeks what is also subject to birth. One who's subject to aging seeks what's subject to aging. Being subject to sickness seeks what's subject to sickness. Being subject to death seeks what's subject to death." And so on. And then there's the noble search. There's Buddha was on a quest, on a search, maybe even, could we go so far as to say seeking? There's a noble kind of search, aspiration. The Buddha says, "Monks, before my enlightenment, or at least we might say before my ceremony of enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what's also subject to birth and subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement? Suppose that, being subject myself to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, nirvana. Suppose that being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, nirvana." Usually, we go about our lives searching and seeking for that which is conditioned. And before Buddhas were enlightened, they were the same as we. Shakyamuni Buddha also sought what was conditioned, what was subject to birth and death. But then he started considering this. So suppose instead I search for the unborn, the deathless, the ageless, the illless, the supreme security from bondage, from the security from being trapped in the net of samsara. But we don't know exactly what we do know how the Buddha then went about his search, but in the Zen tradition, we could summarize it as the search, the noble search. The noble search is think of what doesn't think. Because if we think of thoughts and other objects, they are subject to birth, aging, sickness and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. But that which doesn't think is unborn, is deathless, is unaging, is unailing, is the supreme security from the bondage of being plummeted around in samsara. We call it nirvana, which is just peace. We call our original face before our parents were born. It's not, that face is not older now than when before our parents were born. It's unaging. And it wasn't born sometime after our parents were born, and it won't die sometime after our children are dead. We can call it the one who's not busy, right in the midst of our busyness. We can call it the practice and verification of totally culminated awakening. We can call it the undying person in the hermitage, not separate from this skin bag here and now. We can call it, in the Fukan Zazengi, what doesn't think, not thinking. We can think of what doesn't think. But the way of thinking of what doesn't think is not just like thinking about it, right? How do we think of what doesn't think? Non-thinking. One of Dogen's other comments on this, he says, whenever we think of what doesn't think, we always use non-thinking to do it. Yes.
Does that mean that it's an activity of mind, but it's not the thinking activity?
Yeah.
It's like if the mind is, there's something happening. We're not dead, but it's not thinking.
We're talking about non-thinking?
Yeah, non-thinking.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, it's an activity of mind that's not conceptual thinking, but one might interpret it in this story as a kind of like intentionality or intentionality, not conceptually thinking about something, but attending to that which doesn't think. Yes.
What is it that attempts? I mean, there's the sense that we were talking yesterday about the sense of self and how difficult it is to not have a sense of self. And so something brings the attention back to this idea.
To this practice of attending. What is it that brings it back? You could say the great compassion of the Buddhas and ancestors who offer us such teachings, like think of what doesn't think. How do you think of what doesn't think? Non-thinking or beyond thinking or without thought. I could say we hear that, we hear those words from the ancestors, and then it may be that in Zazen they pop up, they arise in our mind that's just sitting there, and we remember, especially if we hear them again and again and again, think of what doesn't think. How do we think of what doesn't think? Non-thinking. We almost create a habit of remembering such compassionate instructions. And then we're sitting, and we could say someone, while we're sitting, remembers that. It's not exactly me that remembers that teaching, and it's not exactly that the ancestors suddenly inject that teaching into us right at a certain point in some magical way. It's in our relationship with our ancestors, in the devotion to the ancestors, revering these Buddhas and ancestors through their teachings. We are one Buddha and one ancestor. Awakening bodhicitta, awakening this intention of the noble search. We are one bodhicitta. So it is kind of mysterious how in Zazen sometimes we're just swimming around in our thinking, and then sometimes we remember the opportunity.
Zen doesn't talk much about will, development of will.
Yeah.
Because it would seem to me that there's some aspect of will that comes into play, and because the attention has to be continuously, at least for me, brought back from the soup of habit energy, which I also conjecture is that that's part of the reptilian brain, the ego needing to survive, and that's part of the resistance is...
So sometimes in Zen, like in the Fukanza Zengi here, we might say there's teachings about will in the sense of like this, you know, wholehearted engagement, bendo, kufu bendo, like wholehearted effort in the endeavor of the way. Dogen likes to use phrases like that. That seems to be kind of arousing our kind of will. But from a more non-dual perspective, we realize that this is not something that I as a separate self can do. So that I think there are both sides. The instructions to arouse the great effort are, I think, just kind of conventional teachings directed towards our conventional mind, which are helpful. And then from this larger perspective, it's like it's in a way out of our hands, out of our control. So both, yes.
Yeah, a moment ago. Could we also say that it's non-thinking that's doing even the conventional thinking where we're sort of lost in that soup, but that the thinking is just obscured by thinking? It's still the non-thinking activity?
Yeah. We might also say non-thinking is a very fluid movement of the mind without like strong reification, without grasping or rejecting. So it still can be used. It's a functioning of mind, but not in our usual grasping kind of way, which I think is when we're swimming in the soup, kind of lost, then I think we're usually grasping onto it. So something like this.
I feel sometimes that even when there seems to be grasping or a repulsion, that there's still sort of a non-thinking in that. Like if it's embraced, like if it's supported, if it's not this weird soup, if there's clarity, even in the sort of grasping and repulsion, there can be kind of like a tongue-in-cheek with that a little bit. Almost like, oh, okay, I see what's happening here. Oh, I see what's happening here. You know, there's almost like mirroring with it back and forth almost dissolves what it's doing as a grasping or a repulsion.
Yeah, there's
like an intimacy with grasping and repulsion.
Yeah, some awareness of it. And I think there's degrees of that, right? And we can, if it's, especially in Zazen, when we're very supported to, it's just our own minds working, we can watch those tendencies and sometimes we can catch it and say, I see this happening and I'm not going to take it that seriously. It was a little bit like the original Chinese Zazengi that Dogen's basing his on. It presents the essential art of Zazen as whenever a thought arises, be aware of it. As soon as you're aware of it, it will vanish. So it's a little bit like, as I understand what you're saying, is like thoughts are arising and even grasping and rejecting might be arising, but we're aware of them and we kind of see them, and then the tight grasping quality tends to dissipate. And I say there's degrees, because we can, if we're really clear, then just a thought arises, and before it even gets reified, we're just, oh, here's a thought, and it doesn't have a chance to grab a hold of it, and it vanishes. That's what Dogen's saying, or that's what the Chinese Zazengi is saying. And I trying that out a little bit in Zazen these days, I find out really when clear and awake, one can really do that practice of just watching for the next thought arising. Oh, there it is. You can even kind of label it and, oh, it's a thought about such and such, but you're just aware of it. But without grasping it, it has no fuel to continue it, so therefore it vanishes. And I think it's really true. Like the text says, as soon as you're aware of it, it vanishes. And then there's different degrees, like we might not be that attentive to it. So it arises, but we're not just aware of it, we're actually like caught in the content of it. And then we start to reify it and grasp it and elaborate on it. And then we're caught in the bondage. I noticed this.
Firmly rejected or firmly grasped, it almost happens like after. There's almost like a lag.
Yeah.
Like a dullness.
In the lag time, I think we're not aware of it. That's, I think, what it is. And then it almost has like, it has momentum, like a snowball effect of, once we start reifying it and grasping it, then it's got its own momentum, and then the awareness of it recedes further and further into the background usually, and then it gets bigger and bigger, and at some point, if it gets big enough, the snowball that's rolling down the hill getting bigger, at some point it gets big enough, and then we know, whoa, this is painful. And then the awareness starts getting stronger. Oh, well, I created this whole thing, and then maybe it takes a while. Now, as soon as we're aware of the snowball, it's so big that maybe the entire snowball doesn't immediately dissolve. Immediately. We have to melt it like a little bit. It may be that if the attention is really sharp, when it's really big, the snowball can still immediately pulverize it. But I think this is happening all day. Like, after breakfast, I got in, we might call it kind of like an argument, something like that, where I noticed I'm not so, well, just kind of bringing something up about serving forms, right? And then it starts to become like a back and forth thing. And at some point, I realize I'm really grasping. I'm like, I'm like invested in what I'm saying. I'm invested in my thinking. And if I were to step back and say, does this really matter on the sixth day of Sesshin? If a little voice were to ask you, Kokyo, does this matter? I would say, oh yeah, thank you. No, it doesn't. Actually, but that little voice was like, you know, the little one who would say that was rolled over by the snowball. crushed and buried under the snow. And so I thought, wow, this is like, the snowball effect is I'm even more conscious of it in Sesshin, right? And then there's like there's a bodily tension that goes with it. There's this whole thing that then kind of becoming aware of it, and it doesn't disappear immediately. It kind of like takes a little while, but then, you know, then we can say, okay, that's done. Next. but this is like, I feel like that's a time when I feel like I lost the practice of thinking of what doesn't think. Like I'm losing it all the time, but there's times when I kind of like really lose it. Yes?
So the challenge, it seems for me, is for this to be an intellectual process and to lose track of breath and body because of the monitoring. How does one stay with coming back to embodying, to act? Because to me it seems that that's part of being present, is being fully here. The tendency here is to be here.
You mean
a great deal of time here.
You mean thinking of not thinking?
Attention. All the attention is in the head. Yeah, watching whatever's going on, noticing I'm falling asleep. Oh, I'm giving it again. Oh, I'm paying attention now. Now I'm gone. You know, it's, and then at some point, you know, there's a remembering to come back to breath and body. It's not mentioned much, and it seems like that's very hard, at least for this being, to remember that there's more than just the head, unless some physical pain happens, or, you know, stirring it up with someone, of course, that starts a certain vibration in the body, and there's a certain discomfort, you know, with that, right, being out of harmony type of thing, but.
Well, there's a whole middle section, maybe a third of the Fukan Zazengi, that is really just about the body and the breath, right? So that's part of the instructions, is the details of the posture, and take a deep breath, inhale and exhale. And another one of the Fukan Zazengi versions, Dogen talks about making the breath kind of even and subtle kind of breath. So in a way, that's all definitely part of it. We have that foundation. In a way, that's, I would say, the starting point. We can't ever skip over the body and the breath part. That's our foundation. And then when we're quite settled in the body and the breath, then we might take up such a practice of thinking of not thinking, which when it comes out in words and when we're talking about clarifying it in a Dharma talk, it can sound intellectual. But I would propose that the actual practice of thinking of what doesn't think is completely non-intellectual. It maybe just sounds this way, that way, but it's not engaging actually even intellect. Intellect is like thinking. But how do we do the thinking of not thinking? With non-thinking. So it's a this turning the light around and shining back is, if it becomes intellectual exercise, we're losing it. So it's subtle because it's using the mind, but not, I would say, not the intellect. Yes?
It occurs to me that the sequence is part of the story, that it's first the one who is subject to birth and death who has a supposition, just supposes. Well, I suppose.
Yeah.
What would happen?
Yeah.
You know, he's been practicing birth and death practices of the birth and death body.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he supposes it.
Yeah, where does
he
that...
He says, I think I'll think of not thinking.
Yeah.
And then a monk comes by and says, how do you think of not thinking?
Yeah.
And then it occurs to him, and then...
Yeah.
Then non-thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Non-thinking arises, and that's the end of the story.
So... somehow there's an intention, or you could call bodhicitta, an intention to let, and maybe it often comes from suffering, right? It comes from, or I think that's how probably most of us come to this practice, right? Things are not working completely the way we'd like. It's not quite, everything that I've ever done in my life to try to work things out somewhat works, but we have this strong inkling that, like, it doesn't completely work. I think that kind of disenchantment with samsara, we might say, is a part of the birth of bodhicitta. And that's a beautiful thing, even though it's maybe sad to become disenchanted, because enchantment with samsara is so sweet. Disenchantment is kind of like, oh. But in fact, that's a little baby Buddha coming through. And then, of course, in the Mahayana, the full extent of bodhicitta is this aspiration to seek the unborn, undying, deathless. But for the benefit of all beings, and in order to help all beings find this peaceful rest and ease. And so the larger context of all together is worth remembering here, that that which doesn't think, the unborn, deathless, which doesn't think, from which all thoughts arise, is like vast space, it said, right? It has no edges, borders, or boundaries. And therefore, it includes everything. It includes all appearances, right? There's nothing outside of it. Therefore, it doesn't really make sense to say that I, Kokyo, have an unborn, deathless awareness with no boundaries, and you have an unborn, deathless awareness with no boundaries, and they're both all-inclusive. We can see how that doesn't really make sense, right? Therefore, there must be... if there's something that's all-inclusive, there must be only one of them. Maybe that's the simplest way to say it. If something is all-inclusive, with nothing outside of it, there can't be more than one of that. Therefore, this nirvanic, unborn, deathless awareness that doesn't think is that which we all share. That is our true nature, and it's the true nature we share. And it's not even so much like it's divided up into sections, and somebody gets the southeast quadrant and somebody gets the northwest quadrant. because space doesn't have divisions like that, right? It's space-like awareness that we all share. Therefore, one of my favorite sayings that some of you might be sick of hearing, but if you hear it more, then it's more likely that it pops up in Zazen, that ancestor Huang Bo said, all awakened Buddhas and all deluded sentient beings are only this one mind outside of which nothing exists. This one mind that's all-inclusive with nothing outside it is the true nature of all enlightened Buddhas and all deluded sentient beings. We share it all. And it's not the slightest bit different in Buddhas and sentient beings. I think Huang Bo himself says it's not the slightest bit different in either one of them. It's just that the deluded sentient beings believe that they are this limited, believe with their conceptual thought that they are this limited body and mind, individual person. It's who they truly are. So this is I think compassion comes from, the fact that we share the one mind. It is total intimacy. We seem to be separate people. That's the manifestations of it, but truly we're not. We are one mind, and therefore, after this sort of argument session, I thought, how absurd, like, I'm arguing with myself. It doesn't make any sense. But that's how it works, though, right? The manifestations seem to be separate beings, and their karmic situations are different. Their viewpoints on the world are different. So therefore, they can believe they're separate and actually like disagree on some point. But it's like part of the one mind is disagreeing with another part of itself. Amazing. The benefits, of course, then, of realizing and being the one awareness we all share are immense. It may be impossible not to have compassion for another part of ourself. Like, if we cut our toe, the hand doesn't say, that's just some bleeding toe over there. And it's like, no, this is part of me. I'll take care of it. Right? So our whole body is this one mind. We're all part of it. Therefore, from the perspective of this one mind, in the mind, we can call it wisdom. In the heart, we can call it love. In the eyes and ears, we can call it beauty. These are all different names for the same one awareness we share. Yes?
Think of not thinking. You remind me of the saying that all that we are arises with our thought, behind each thought is our entire karma.
Yes.
Like a train pushing that thought.
Yes.
And we can't stop it, but maybe we can exhaust it. Exhausted, it gets tired.
In Sesshin, sometimes I have that experience, actually. The earlier part of Sesshin, it's the train's going full speed ahead, right? And then it does become exhausting after a while. Like sometimes I was doing like a whole sort of autobiographical life review, like the first day of Sesshin, year by year. I was almost like writing it down in my mind. This was a good year, and this. And then this year period was like that. And I'm like, oh man, I spent like hours doing that. And it was exhausting. And at some point I'm like, I didn't just stop it, unfortunately. But at some point it like wore itself out. I'm like, okay, we did that autobiography. I can fold it up and put it on the shelf. So it's true. You could say who our separate self, individual person, is like this, is just like the culmination of all our karma from this life and maybe even infinite past lives, culminating on this one present experience of this body and mind with this particular karmic inclinations and thought patterns. And I would say from a more non-dual perspective, it's not even so much that we need to exhaust that. Sometimes in the early sutras, it sounds like the karmic self, limited self being, is like, you know, blown out and exhausted. But from a more non-dual perspective, we might say we just see that the momentum of this karmic self that's been created from beginningless time up to now is just a manifestation of this one great awareness. We don't even need to exhaust it. It's the play of the one mind. It's beautiful, actually, when we see it as such. So it's not like we need to do anything about it, really. It's more like just the shift of perspective, like, oh, this is just, it's like watching a movie. And sometimes it's a really crazy movie, but from this Zen perspective, it's like, we don't need to end the movie, we don't need to change the movie, we don't need to like spiff up the movie. It's just fine as it is, and that's all it is. It's just a movie called My Autobiography. This year, look at this. It was a movie review I was doing, and which was like a...
He was talking about cessation. Right? You cease all the movements of the conscious mind. And what is cessation? Is extinction.
Cease all the movements of the conscious mind. The gauging of all thoughts and views. Indeed, that I agree that sentence in the Fukan Zazengi does sound like almost like a kind of like cutting off or something. But we could also hear it as that is not the essential art of Zazen. That's like a preliminary instruction, because the text says right. It's before turning the light around, isn't it? I'm pretty sure that Dogen says, cast aside all involvements and cease all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not administer pros and cons. Cease all the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha. It is after turning the light around, but then it's before setting the body into this posture and the breathing and so on. I would, you know, I think this could be interpreted in different ways. Cessation. Yeah, we could say the movements of the conscious mind here is the movements of the eighth, the seventh, and the sixth consciousness, like technically. So like the way dualistic consciousness grasps objects. That would be how, I'm not saying this is how Dogen is saying it, but I would interpret it as cease the movements of all the dualistic consciousnesses would be like settle the grasping at objects separate from the subjects. Dualistic consciousness is the split mind. So cease the movement in this divided mind. Settle into presence. That would be one way to hear it. And it still seems like that's the... a kind of almost like, these are almost like the section of kind of practicalities of zazen, right? Like, have a quiet room, eat and drink moderately, cease the movements of the conscious mind. Sounds like a tall order, actually, right? But we might say on a kind of gross level, I don't know if it would make as much sense if Dogen meant here, a quiet room is suitable, eat and drink moderately. Now realize complete nirvana. Now cross your legs this way and like, you know. Although it could be that in a way nirvana pervades the entire Fukan Zazengi from the start to the end, we could say, because that's the reality. But in general, Zen teachings seem to be emphasizing that we never have to, destroy samsara in order to realize nirvana. The early sutras of the Buddha do tend to kind of imply that. They're a little bit, it could be said to be a little bit more dualistic sounding, and you have to change something in order to realize the way. Whereas the radical non-dual teachings are like, without moving a particle, we chanted this morning, you extend the Buddha's great activity, the incomparably sublime and subtle Dharma, without changing even the slightest thing. It's just, except for our perspective, which is not actually changing something, it's just looking at something a different way, right? So just like those optical illusions where you see a vase in the center and two faces on each side. We're used to seeing the vase, maybe. Some of us see the vase, some see two faces. But if the shift of perspective is from seeing the vase to the two faces, is that moving a particle? I would say no, we don't move a particle. We don't change anything at all. It's the same picture, but we're just looking at it in a different way. So we don't change samsara. We just look at samsara in a different way. We don't literally have to stop thinking completely. We just have to look at it in a different way. We don't have to eliminate dualistic consciousness. We just have to see that dualistic consciousness is not really dualistic, because objects really aren't outside of mind. So, after we've been sitting for a while, when you arise from sitting, move slowly and quietly, calmly and deliberately. Do not rise suddenly or abruptly. This is.
You can't do that on the sixth day anyway.
Yeah. And actually, interestingly, Dogen doesn't say in this text, but it seems to be a later Soto Zen practice, that just as you rock the body right and left and settle into a steady, immovable sitting position, at the end of Zazen, it seems to be a tradition maybe after Dogen, to when the bell rings, you also rock the body right and left if you're sitting cross-legged, in widening arcs instead of narrowing arcs. Again, maybe a little yoga stretch before standing up. So maybe the point here is, besides the literal meaning, we could say the feeling behind this is like making the transition from sitting zazen in the vast space of awareness to our more active activities. Be careful when we do this, do it, don't just jump into an activity because we might lose it. Make the transition into activity kind of gradual, Dogen seems to be saying. In the original Chinese Zazen Yi, the text says, when you come out of samadhi, move slowly and quietly, calmly and deliberately. After you have left this samadhi of presence, always employ appropriate means to protect and maintain the power of samadhi as though you were protecting an infant. Then your samadhi power will easily develop. So that's maybe part of the meaning. In Dogen's first Fukan Zazengi, he also said that at all times protect and maintain this Jōriki is the power of samadhi, like a kind of presence that we develop in Zazen, protect it. And the original text says it's like an infant, be careful. That's why we get up from the zafu, like taking care of this infant. In surveying the past, we find the transcendence of both unenlightenment and enlightenment. And really, I think a better translation, more literal, is transcendence, or going beyond ordinary and sacred, or ordinary and holy, is really what the text says, which is going beyond the ideas that this is just an ordinary activity, especially like, you know, tripping on the ground and falling or something. Oh, that's not like a sacred activity. We go beyond the idea that that's ordinary. And then the sacred, like zazen or chanting the sutras of the Buddhas, well, that's actually just ordinary. It's not so sacred. So we go beyond these ideas. And sesshin is good for this. Everything becomes kind of like, goes beyond our ideas of ordinary and holy. So transcending them, going beyond ordinary and holy, and dying while either sitting or standing have all depended entirely on the strength of zazen, or this power of zazen. So this footnote says in the transmission of the lamp records, it said that Bodhidharma, the first ancestor in China, as well as the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth ancestors in China, died while sitting in zazen, like literally at the end of their life. So I think it was somewhat common practice in the old days for like some hardcore yogis to like, it's hard to imagine, right? Because usually when death is approaching, we're usually like pretty weak and usually not conscious. Has anyone ever met or heard of anyone who died so suddenly, but not like in a car accident or something, but died while like their eyes are open and they could be talking to people and then just like suddenly go? This probably has happened, but I think usually the person's, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Or it wasn't my class. It was a Chinese man that died while he was walking.
Wow, yeah.
Just fell over.
So I think maybe a heart attack.
That's the only time I ever experienced that, though.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe a heart attack or stroke. It's pretty quick, actually, from completely conscious to actually dead. But it sounds like some of the Zen stories you hear, like they know they're going to die, these Zen ancestors, right? And they say, actually, tomorrow I'm going to die. And so let's have a feast together. And then they write their death poem, they recite it, and then they put on their robes and they sit in zazen posture and die. There's even one koan in the Book of Serenity that's really almost absurd. It's like these two monks having a koan like conversation, and one of them says something like, my practice is such that before this incense gets to the bottom, I can die. I'll show you. And he does it. And the other one's like, that was a waste. So there's more to the story, but I thought, oh, was that true?
Ah, yeah. They don't have any breaths. they have left. And so they slow their breathing down so that they can die at that moment. And they have, you know, probably know about the chin rest.
Yeah.
And they can do that while they're sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's maybe Dogen's is celebrating the awesome and mysterious power of Zazen, that and I think when we hear these, and you know, of course there's the examples of self-immolation where as protest monks in the past and still in present day, even in the last years in Nepal and Tibet, as a protest to the Chinese government, will light themselves on fire, and to be able to sit upright when literally that's sitting upright dying, right? Well, on fire, is not recommended to do at home. And, but it does show something about how, where I see it is like, if we're really deeply trusting the unborn, deathless awareness, it's like, And that what we call the physical body is kind of like a dream body, then I think that's what it maybe would be necessary to be able to withstand the literal dropping off of the body, right, at that point. We have to again trust something deeper than the body, and like the Buddha says, the supreme security from all bondage, that is security from birth and death even. So this is a strong, maybe one of the strongest statements in the Fukan Zazengi. And the note says, it says in this one record that the third ancestor, Kanti Sōsan, died while standing under a large tree. So that's, and maybe it wasn't planned, right? Maybe it was a heart attack, but that's what's being referred to, supposedly.
Was the third ancestor the
Xin Ming ancestor?
The beginning of it sounds a lot like the Xin Ming.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if that text was used in the original, his teacher's monastery.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, and you know, as we heard Dogen quoted. Oh, you weren't here in the earlier days. It's actually, yeah, there's direct quotes from the Xin Xin Ming are in the Fukan Zazengi. Yeah, drawing directly. Drawing from a lot of different things, but that's one of the big ones, and I think the Xin Xin Ming is... Yeah, I think it was one of the most renowned Zen poems in China and Japan in Dogen's time. Yeah, yeah. A lot of the koans are also quote lines from the Xin Xin Ming. So it's almost like the most classic Zen teaching, and it's beautiful. We'll chant it tomorrow morning for you. This dying while either sitting or standing depend entirely on the strength of Zazen. In addition, the bringing about of enlightenment by the opportunity provided by a finger, a banner, a needle, or a mallet, and the effecting of realization with the aid of a whisk, a fist, a staff, or a shout, cannot be fully understood by discriminative thinking. So, this is one of these lists referring to lots of Zen stories. The bringing about of enlightenment by the opportunity provided by these is, we could say, maybe more literal translations are like triggering awakening, or the turning opportunity provided by these events. And these are a bunch of Zen stories that don't involve words at all, or very few words, but they involve like direct presentations. And it's kind of nice, I think, to celebrate these stories. So here's some Zen stories, starting with finger. The finger story. I bet you've heard some of these, right? whenever Master Judy was questioned, he would just raise one finger. And you know what this is about, right? It's the one mind which is all Buddhas and all sentient beings. It's the answer to every question, right, from the ultimate. And later, a novice monk, when visitors to the temple asked what his teacher taught, the monk would answer them in the same way. And when Judy heard of this, he cut off the boy's finger. And the boy ran out screaming in pain, but when Judy called him, "Wait a minute," he looked back, and the teacher raised one finger, and the boy was greatly awakened. So great awakening happened when seeing a finger raised. This is beyond discrimination, right? The banner story is Ananda asked Mahakashyapa, "Elder Dharma brother, did the Buddha transmit anything else to you besides the golden robe?" And Kashyapa said, "Ananda." Similar. And Ananda said, "Yes." And Kashyapa said, "Take down the banner in front of the gate." And Ananda realized great awakening. The needle story. Kanadeva went to Nagarjuna, who placed a bowl of water before Kanadeva. And Kanadeva put a needle in the bowl of water and then offered the bowl of water with a needle in it back to Nagarjuna. And at that time they met joyfully and realized they were of like minds. I'm not going to comment because these are beyond discrimination.
You had to be there.
You can read some of that stories in Kazan's Transmission of Light. The mallet, also called a sui in Japanese. We have one over there next to the zendo that Jean kindly built. This octagonal block on top of a tall octagonal block is called the mallet is called a sui, and the bottom on the block is called qin. So we say sui qin. It's the combination of them. Mallet and block. And one day Buddha ascended the teaching seat and Manjushri struck the mallet and said, "Clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus." And Buddha got down from the seat. When hearing the mallet struck, maybe 84,000 beings were awakened. Whisk. There's a lot of whisk stories, you know, the hosu, the fly whisk, is that the Zen ancestors carried. Here's one that we can cover two at once. We can cover a whisk and shout in one story. Baijong was the attendant of Matsu, and Matsu's whisk was sitting next to his seat, and Baijong pointed to it and said, "If someone uses this whisk, can he also not use it?" Matsu said, "In the future, in your Zen travels, how will you help people?" And Baijong picked up Matsu's whisk and held it up. And Matsu said, "If you use it in this way, what other way can it be used?" Baijong put the whisk back down. Then Matsu suddenly let out an earth-shaking shout so loud that Baijong was deaf for 3 days. Then that story became celebrated as like Matsu's great shout of all shouts. And then that lineage became kind of a shouting lineage. Baijong, his student, got into shouting. And Huangbo also got into shouting. And then Linji became one of the king of shouters. Cuts! So, the fist. We need a fist story. Jiaozhou went to a hermit and asked him, Is there? And the hermit held up a fist. And Jiaozhou said, a ship cannot moor where the water is shallow. And he left. Then Jiaozhou went to see another hermit living in the mountains and asked the same question, is there? And that hermit also lifted up his fist. And Jiaozhou said, can concede, can deny, can kill, can enliven, and bowed. And staff. Baijong entered the hall to give a Dharma talk, and the monks were all standing in rows ready for the talk, and Baijong suddenly scattered them with his staff, kind of knocking them all around. They all started running out of the room, and as they were running out, he said, wait a minute, monks! And they all turned around, and he said, what is it? The turning opportunity provided by a finger, a banner, a needle, or a mallet, and the effecting of realization with the aid of a whisk, a fist, a staff, or a shout cannot be fully understood by discriminative thinking. Indeed, it cannot be fully known by the practicing or realizing of supernatural powers either. Like, is this something supernatural, like divine eye and divine ear and reading others' minds? Is there some supernatural power here? No, it's not like that. It must be deportment beyond seeing and hearing. Is it not a principle that is prior to knowledge and perceptions? So this deportment beyond hearing and seeing is a quote. There's many, many quotes in the Fugan Zazengi of other Zen stories. And this one is about Xiang Yan, who is a similar story to all the staff and shout stories. He's the one who was asked by his teacher something like, without referring to all the things you've heard in the sutras and have studied, all your intellectual ideas about Dharma, say something yourself about your original faith before your parents were born. How would you put it from your own experience about your original faith? And Xiang Yan said, wait just a minute. And he went back to his room and he started looking through his books and he said, it must be in here somewhere. And he couldn't find it, and he realized this is ridiculous, and he went back to his teacher, and he's like, I'm sorry, I can't answer you, and in fact, I feel not so good that I can't answer. In fact, like, I think I even have to leave the temple now. I can't do this Zen stuff, but I can devotedly take care of devotion to the ancestors. So he went to some ancestors' memorial up in the mountains and swept the memorial site and cleaned the stupa of this ancestor. It's like, I need to just do some devotional practice, I think. But while he was sweeping one day, a pebble, flew off the broom and hit the bamboo and went. And when he heard, he was greatly awakened. So this fits nicely into this list of fingers and needles and mallets, right? Without anybody saying anything, body and mind dropped off. And then, right after that, he bowed in the direction of his teacher, who never was willing to explain for him, and said, "I thank you for never explaining to me, but let me write a poem to celebrate this." And his poem was like, had these lines of deportment beyond hearing and seeing, no trace anywhere. Those who've mastered the way call this unsurpassed activity. So Dogen's, I think, nicely quoting that little line that maybe hardly anyone noticed, that it was referring to that Xiang Yan's celebration of his pebble story. Dogen does this kind of stuff all the time. He weaves in all these references and appropriate references, but you really have to, like, you know, really research a lot to see what Dogen's doing sometimes. Another translation of deportment beyond hearing and seeing, it's this igi, so like dignified manner or awesome presence beyond sound and form. So something about this, that which doesn't think, that which is always clear and aware, actually just completely ordinary mind, not something special or hidden, but just that which we're not attending to because we're so into the objects of mind, we're so into experiences that we forget the experiencing of them. But that experiencing operates in all kinds of unusual ways, beyond limited ideas, beyond seeing and hearing. The great way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it depend on our practice and realization? When a positive energy gathered from our meeting today, we offer to all awakened beings, may they extend with true compassion their luminous mirror wisdom. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.